Good evening, and welcome to Vanity Fair Magazine. Hi, I'm Paul Droba. Well, as you may have noticed, we don't open up our show with music. We don't have that ability at the moment. We're working on that, and in the near future, we can when it's needed. If we had music, tonight we would have opened up with a song. If you're of a certain age, you'll remember it. If not, I'm sure you've heard it somewhere. It's Miss Marilyn Monroe, and Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. That's a little tip-off as to what our story is about tonight. So if you don't remember the song, I'm just going to give you a little bit of a hint. So you might want to turn your volume down because this won't be pretty. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Okay, that's enough. All right, so we're talking diamonds tonight. I don't know a lot about jewelry. I don't wear jewelry, but I am familiar with the name Harry Winston. And the reason that is because Harry Winston is the jewelers to the stars. And I always watch the Academy Awards, and so you have all the actresses walking down the red carpet, and they'll get stopped for an interview. And of course, that famous line that the interviewer always asks, she'll say, "Your diamonds are just gorgeous. Who are you wearing tonight?" And the actress will reply, "I'm wearing Harry Winston." And the reporters who are covering it will say that the diamonds that the actress was wearing that night are worth $5, $10, $15, sometimes $20 million. And she's wearing those diamonds and walking around. So it makes me think about our story tonight, because we're talking about a diamond robbery. A famous diamond robbery took place in Paris, France, and they robbed the Harry Winston boutique. It's a great story because not only did they rob it once, but they robbed it twice. In a period of about 8 months, they robbed it twice. Now, there's a lot of value in those diamonds. Hundreds of millions, well, certainly tens of millions of dollars in diamonds. And as our article will explain a little bit, all the latest high-tech security you could imagine. Not only do they have high-tech security, but they have armed personnel and guards. It should be almost impossible to rob a Harry Winston diamond store. But they did. They did. But that's not the good part. The good part is they did it in broad daylight. They didn't tunnel up from the basement, or they didn't drop from the sky like the Mission Impossible movies. They walked straight in the front door in daylight. And the second thing is they did it twice. Twice they robbed the store. So I'm thinking about the actors. I'm getting ready to read this story, and I'm thinking about those actresses who are wearing $15, $20 million worth of jewelry. And I think, well, you know, she's not alone. There's some big, beefy guys with bulges in their jacket that are surrounding her. But I'm thinking these guys in Paris were able to break into a Harry Winston store in broad daylight and loot, empty the store. Here's one little girl who's wearing all that $20 million in diamonds, and she's got big, hulky guys protecting her, but if they could do that twice in broad daylight, I'd be real, real nervous. If it were me, and I don't wear jewelry, but if it were me, I'd go with costume jewelry. I'd let everybody know this stuff looks great, but it's costume. So please don't kill me. So anyhow, that's the lead into our story tonight. Our story is titled Diamonds in the Rough, and the blurb that precedes it reads, "The thieves who stole $37 million in jewels from Harry Winston, Paris, committed the perfect crime. Their mistake was returning for another, even bigger score. But did police really solve the crime, or are the brains of the operation still at large?" So, let's begin and find out how these guys did it, and did they get caught? Four hooded thieves were already inside Harry Winston, Paris, along with $36 million $683,281 in well-defended jewels when the boutique opened on October 6, 2007. How they got there defied explanation. The keys, which are kept off-site each night by a protective services company, were delivered as usual to Harry Winston's security guard at 9:30 a.m. Following protocol, the guard then waited outside the building for the staff to arrive. Employees are not permitted to enter the premises alone, nor may they leave with the keys. Harry Winston is famous for selling, as its motto puts it, rare jewels of the world. The Paris retail outlet occupies a neoclassical chateau on Avenue Montaigne in the luxe Golden Triangle district of the Champs-Élysées, set among such haute couture flagships as Dior, Gucci, and Valentino. One emerald necklace at Harry Winston that Saturday cost nearly $3 million. It would soon vanish, along with all the other rocks in the store. The heist lasted less than half an hour. It began at 9:50 a.m. when Import-Export Director Anne-Marie Capdeville arrived, authorizing the security guard to open the side entrance. They passed through the safety vestibule, and he turned off the general alarm. Harry's grand salon smelled the way it always does, a faint fragrance of white orchids. The guard dropped off the keys at his workstation, then headed to the bathroom, passing glass display cases of ruby earrings, sapphire cluster bracelets, and platinum watches frosted with brilliance. There was no reason to think, given the sophisticated alarm system in place and the police station a few doors down the block, that the entirety of the shop's glittering contents could be stolen, especially in the right bank daylight. Capdeville walked up the sweeping main staircase to her office on the third floor, not realizing that four armed men in balaclavas were hidden in the service stairwell. They crouched behind a closed door, holding their breath. Capdeville stepped into her office. As she sat down at her desk, they pounced, grabbing her by the throat. The robbers carried bludgeons and handguns. They were disguised as utility workmen in painters' coveralls. Repairmen in similar attire had been renovating the structure for weeks. Holding Capdeville's head down, they demanded to know how many of her co-workers were present. Only one, she told them. Two of the burglars stalked off to find him, the soles of their boots tracking flecks of fire extinguisher foam along the diamond-patterned carpeting. They took the guard by surprise, in the bathroom, striking him in the head. Hard enough to seriously scare him, but not to knock him unconscious. They needed him awake. The other two carried a terrified Capdeville downstairs to the bathroom, leaving her face down on the floor, her arms secured with industrial ties. The bandits marched the security officer back to his post. Under their watch, other staff members could now be allowed in without alerting anyone. The next to arrive was manager Mathieu Pichet, who'd driven to work with two of the store's hostesses. After parking in the private lot behind the building, the trio filed through the securitized vestibule. Once inside, the young women were seized by the hair, dragged to the bathroom, frisked to ensure they couldn't call for help, then tied up like Capdeville. The manager was led up the central staircase with the barrel of a gun on his neck. Ordered to open the safe, Bichet started fumbling with the lock. In his panic, he could not remember the combination. The gun pressed harder into him. "Get Bernice," he pleaded. Marie Bernice Belsac, a sales associate who had just arrived and been handcuffed alongside the others, was untied and whisked to the third floor, where she entered the code to the safe. As the robbers transferred the jewels out of their display cases, iridescent shards of color flashed in their eyes. One of the men directed Bernice back downstairs, through marble-columned archways, to another safe containing the timepieces. He wore a bob, a bucket hat, atop his ski mask. He also had a remarkably big, crooked nose. "Don't worry, Bernice. I'm nicer than the others," he assured her as they filled a bag with rose-gold triple tourbillons. "Farid, there's no more time. There's no more time," one of the burglars yelled to the nose in the bob. They grabbed the video surveillance tapes and sprayed tear gas on the tied-up hostages, then bolted through the back exit into a rented Peugeot minivan. Cameras filmed them making their getaway down Avenue Montaigne. None of the 480 pieces taken that day have ever been recovered. Wiping their eyes, employees told police that, apart from the name Farid, they'd also overheard a fellow gang member being called Voldemort, a Harry Potter reference that, in the midst of a Harry Winston break-in, telegraphed a measure of clever self-awareness. The only other words staff could remember them uttering were Zarka and Ak. Beyond that, the criminals left almost no clues behind. No fingerprints, no identifiable DNA traces. But despite the lack of evidence, there were suspects. To hit high jewelers in the heart of Paris requires a level of systematic planning and experience. An organization, in short, explains General Counsel Pascal Faure, an attorney general who prosecutes organized crime at the Paris Court of Appeal. Given the preparations involved, it looked like the work of hardcore gangsters from the low-cum suburbs outside Paris. Otherwise, it could only have been Les Pinks. Les Pinks are the Pink Panthers, a shadowy syndicate of jewel thieves hailing primarily from the Balkans. Over the past two decades, Interpol estimates that they pulled off close to 400 jobs around the world, worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They got their name in 2003, when London police found a stolen blue diamond ring inside a container of face cream, a subterfuge lifted from the Inspector Clouseau film series. What Fure and his colleagues wanted to know was, were the Pink Panthers behind the Harry Winston heist? After helping the Paris Stores team to their feet, gendarmes found the service stairway covered in blue-green powder. Fire extinguishers had been emptied all over the stairwell to erase traces, as the group had spent the night there. It felt like a nod to the 1955 French film noir Riffi, in which villains use extinguishers to silence a high-end jewelry store's alarm. There are often cinematic elements to the Pink Panthers' stick-ups, such as To Catch a Thief, style speedboat getaways from the Côte d'Azur. Just as criminals imitate films, so can law enforcement. Take Attorney General Faure, with his elegant side-parted silvery coif and classic trench coat, which he wears with the collar popped, he resembles a detective from a Nouvelle Vague film. Although tall and fit, Faure also shares traits with Chief Inspector Dreyfus, Clouseau's boss in the Pink Panther films. Both occupy offices with fireplaces and filing cabinets next to their desks inside the Palace of Justice of Paris. And while Dreyfus had a facial tic that made his left eye twitch uncontrollably when confronted with Clouseau's bumblings, Faure's right eye, which is heavy-lidded, has a tendency to squint shut into a prolonged wink when emphasizing certain words like Kalashnikov or diamonds. At those moments, his other eye fixes you with knife-like incisiveness, as though peering into the depths of an amethyst. He speaks English, albeit in a glottal, Peter Sellers-esque French accent. He refers to armed robbers who employ violence as dirty boys. Harry Winston was what we call a coup d'etat. A stunning coup, very rare, says Faure, his right eye closing for a few beats. A high-spectrum armed robbery that can only have been executed by serious individuals at the top of the heap, as your Frank Sinatra would say, of grand banditry. To get a sense of what the Pink Panthers are all about, it helps to speak directly with them. One of their founding members is Pavle Punch Stanimirovic. A self-declared gem heist mastermind, Stanimirovic is now retired and willing to talk openly about the Panthers' infrastructure. There's no head, there's no end. There's no tail, there's no beginning. You're talking to the it. You are talking to the highest of the highest. You're talking to Oz, the man behind the mirror. It's me, he says. What I did, I was the best. His area of expertise includes shutting off alarms, picking locks, and opening vaults filled with jewels. He claims to be able to crack a safe in less than 16 seconds. I am probably the fastest in the world, he says. I could take the world apart and put it back together before the afternoon. According to Stanimirovic, some of the Pink Panthers are men who fought in the Balkan Wars, which helps explain their paramilitary brazenness. The Panthers smashed cars through the windows of a Graff storefront in Dubai, and in Tokyo they made off with the Comtesse de Vendome necklace in what was deemed the greatest robbery in the history of Japan. The Panthers also know how to move hot property, Stanimirovic says. In addition to being traceable in the open market, high-profile jewels like those sold by Harry Winston are so exorbitant that buyers are limited to a supremely wealthy and unscrupulous circle. The precise extent and membership of the Pinks remain unknown. French officials describe the mob as a transnational spiderweb. You pull one string and you find a group of others. Some of their troops are berry farmers. Others work menial jobs. One of them, Rachko Kosovey, takes credit for forming a group of gentlemen thieves with style. Pink Panther is a system. We created a system. We were never violent. Stanimirovic echoes this sentiment. I did hundreds of heists, smash and grabs, all different types of burglaries, anything that did not hurt people. His nickname, Punch, refers not to a tendency to hit people, but rather his ability to rapidly crack vaults and safe deposit boxes using borescopes, fiber optics, and a method he calls the punch. You know the thing that shoots cows in the head? I used to use that a lot. Something similar to that, the hydraulic gun, he explains, making the sound of three shots being fired. You just punch them right out, you know. I used to use a thermal lance, 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit, hot as the sun. It melts steel, concrete, vaults, safes, rooms, whatever you want. It'll melt a whole building in half. One curiosity about the Harry Winston case is that the building is equipped with volumetric radars, meaning any movement at all within the structure should have been detected. Investigators could see no reason why the sensors were not triggered. Given almost magical inexplicability of what happened with those alarms, is it possible that the Pink Panthers were behind it? Sure, yeah, could be, of course, without a question, Punch replies. Shortly before midnight on February 8, 2008, 4 months after the robbery, police spotted a brand new Renault Megane burning red lights in the suburbs of Bogany at speeds over 75 miles per hour. The driver, an inebriated 42-year-old man named Farid Alou, was coming from a neighboring commune in the northeastern Parisian suburbs called Noisy-le-Sec. The roads he was racing down bisect an industrial zone called the Folie, which translates as the madness. The driver, too, was in a state of delirium. A hulking, blockheaded thug with a large, disjointed nose and a scar running from cheek to chin, Alou had spent most of his adult life in prison, mainly on armed robbery and aggravated assault charges. At that moment, he was free. Perhaps the most free he'd ever been in his life. No traffic lights or rules of civic engagement could hold him back, at least until he spied those blue lights in his rearview mirror. Alou stepped on the pedal, trying to shake them. When the flicks finally managed to chase him down, they found 40,000 euros in his pocket. He claimed to have gotten the wad, all 500 and 200 euro bills, from an acquaintance in a bar, whom he would not name. Alou was unemployed. He'd purchased the car that week, he informed officers, with still more cash. The bills in his possession had trace amounts of heroin and cocaine on them. Alou, a Frenchman of Algerian heritage, had not lived an easy life. Placed into a violent residential school for troubled youth at 8 years old, he dropped out in the fifth grade. He struggled with depression and, at the age of 20, learned he was HIV positive. From that moment on, he decided that he had nothing to live for, except crime. Alou was charged with armed robbery the same year he was diagnosed with the illness. There's no treatment. You know you're going to croak, he has said, so you want to feel the essential marrow of life. The essential marrow of life became harder and harder for Alou to grasp. Each time he was released from prison, he'd soon get caught again. By the time he was pulled over that February night, he'd been found guilty of 8 felonies and served 20 years in prison. Psychiatric evaluations characterized him as feeling persistent contempt toward the rights and property of others. Fortunately for Alou, police had no cause to suspect him of being the Farid whose name was dropped at the burglary. They did, however, seize the 40,000 euros until he could provide proof of where he had gotten it. 10 months later, on December 3, 2008, Alou informed police that he'd gathered the necessary paperwork. The very next day, Harry's was ransacked again, this time for $73.3 million, in what French media dubbed the break-in of the century. At 5:20 p.m. on Thursday, December 4th, a group of 4 tall men, 3 of them dressed like women, wheeled a suitcase up to Harry's front door. The security guard took a quick look. Silk scarves, long blonde hair, high heels, stockings, and buzzed them in. Shoppers at the Louis Vuitton store across the street informed security about men in drag entering Harry Winston. Another witness, a Cartier salesperson, immediately pegged them as burglars, given their heights and builds, as well as their outlandish outfits. Still, he shrugged it off when, after using the intercom, they were duly admitted into the building. A hostess greeted the foursome and guided them up the main staircase. Harry Winston customers typically pursue pieces in comfortable sitting rooms appointed with blue, velvet, and gold accents. They do so beneath the gaze of security guards who report customers' movements to a central monitoring desk via lavalier microphones. Whenever a display case is opened or a jewel handled, the action is verbalized, precisely but quietly. In this case, the cross-dressers did not make it to the private sales rooms. Midway up the stairs, they pulled out weapons, including a hand grenade. "Nobody move or I will smoke you all," one of them yelled, waving a .357 Magnum around. They stormed into the manager's office, ordering everyone to lie on the ground, face down. Several captives were marshaled to help deactivate alarms and open display cases. Throughout, they called employees by their names, even stating home addresses, a scare tactic intended to dissuade them from revealing details of the holdup to officials. The robbers had other intel. They knew that a 31-carat diamond solitaire ring had been delivered the day before, and they knew where it was, hidden in a secret compartment at the bottom of the main safe. La Grosse Pierre, as the ring became known in the press, was alone worth $8 million. The hoods stuffed the loot into their rolling suitcase. Threatening to detonate that grenade if anyone followed them, they took off with 297 jewels and 100 watches. There are no price tags on any Harry Winston jewels, but the heist was soon revealed to be the costliest in the history of France, and it took only 20 minutes to execute. If the Panthers were behind the second Harry Winston robbery, it qualified as their biggest, most spectacular coup yet. Either way, the perpetrators made one key blunder. They spoke. Employees testified that the men had Slavic accents, which, alongside the theatricality of their get-ups, again suggested Panther involvement. Of course, there is a hypothesis that it is the Pink Panthers, confirmed Isabelle Montagny, a spokeswoman for the Paris Prosecutor's Office, to media in the aftermath. But we cannot, at this stage, say absolutely that it is them. In the original The Pink Panther from 1963, one character is an insurance underwriter from Lloyd's of London. Lloyd's also covered the real-life jewels at both Winston robberies. Their loss adjuster affiliate in Paris is John Shaw, a detail-oriented Scot with a genial, bemused demeanor. The second robbery was so big that Lloyd's offered a $1 million reward for information leading to the recovery of the merchandise. Shaw did not advertise in the bourgeois dailies like Le Monde or Le Figaro, but rather in Le Parisien, a popular paper in the suburbs. Le Parisien gets left at zinc bars in the projects, Shaw says. That's where robbers have come from in the past. Until the Pinks came along, it was often someone from there. Because the Pinks were the other targets, he also placed ads in Montenegro and Serbia. His firm received a flurry of replies. "We got the usual mediums, psychics, witch doctors, Ouija board people, you know. Is there anybody out there? Types?" Shaw says. Most of it needed to be filtered out. But then a credible-sounding informant contacted him from Romania. The caller claimed that the Harry Winston thieves had set up shop in a hotel suite in Bucharest, where they were selling the jewels. French police were skeptical. Who would buy tens of millions of dollars worth of gems in Romania? On the other hand, Bucharest is not too far from the Panthers' native soil. Apparently, the guys in the hotel were blowing off about being the biggest jewel robbers on the planet, Shaw says. They were saying they'd done Winston. French investigators secured warrants and busted a group selling stolen jewels in the appointed hotel room. Unfortunately, they were not Harry Winston jewels. They'd been taken from another store in Normandy on the same day. The whole thing was a bit of a palaver, Shaw admits. It led to arrests, but no reward. Detectives were not discouraged, however. In addition to their witnesses' accounts of Slavic accents, they'd found fingerprints on a Max and Enjoy Paris handbag accidentally left at the scene of the second robbery. Better still, the video surveillance tapes had not disappeared this time around. Investigators reviewing the footage were struck by the behavior of one in-house security agent, Mahloud Djenad. During the second robbery, he had moved about freely and could have easily alerted authorities. Djenad had not been present for the first burglary, but he had locked up the previous evening. Djenad and his girlfriend had recently spent splashy weekends in the French resort town of Deauville, with him paying for everything in cash. And his social media account showed that he was friends with a shopkeeper who happened to be selling the exact same model of the Max and Enjoy purse forgotten at Harry Winston. The store was in Ingenheim, Baines, which is where police went next. The gambling town of Ingenheim-les-Bains, 10 miles north of Paris, has a horse track and the only casino in the greater Paris region, a shining lakeshore beacon offering France's widest selection of games. Those with little means but big dreams tend to congregate at a shady interzone tobacco bar called La Devette, where Le Parisien is often lying around. La Devette sells cigars and sharp knives. Most customers come here to use the video lottery terminals or bet on horse races and sporting events. "Don't throw your ticket scratchings or cigarette butts on the floor," instructs a messily handwritten sign on the wall. The floor is, nevertheless, covered in ticket stubs and scraps. A multicultural, overwhelmingly male clientele drinks beer or brandy, even early in the morning. Behind the bar, a garishly made-up waitress in leather pants chews gum with open disdain. It was in this den of gamblers, police soon discovered, that the Harry Winston capers were devised. In the lead-up to the first robbery, Djenad went regularly to a nearby gym in Ingenheim. He'd brag in the locker room about his job working among models and celebrities, and about security lapses he'd noticed. A friend named Patrick Chenea listened intently and reacted unexpectedly. His sister was married to a gangster, he said, someone capable of pulling off the job. Djenad thought he was kidding, trying to make himself seem important. Patrick worked in construction. He did not fit the bill, Djenad said. When he brought it up again, I did not pay any attention. Then, in September of 2007, Patrick took him to La Devette to meet his 43-year-old brother-in-law, Duaudi Yahaioi, known as Dudu, meaning stuffed toy or safety blanket. A broad-shouldered boilermaker, Dudu had spent 16 years in jail for drug trafficking and robbery, among other offenses, during which time he befriended Farid Alou. Dudu was mentally sharp, but his lust for plunder went so far that officials considered him someone for whom imprisonment had lost any rehabilitating potential. Dudu drove a Jaguar and owned several rundown hotel bars in the seedier reaches of Noisy-le-Sec, the suburb that Alou had been coming from when he was arrested for running red lights. After the meeting at La Devette, Dudu filled in his partner in crime, telling him how easy it would be to break into Harry Winston. "That's it?" Alou said. "Bakeries in the suburbs have better security than that." Their inside man, Djenad, tried to back out. Don't disappoint me, Dudu warned him, adding that he could send guys around to speak sense into him. In talks peppered with Argat, Dudu went on about their shared Algerian heritage, about their parents who had slaved away for nothing. They solidified the plan over whiskey and cigars in Dudu's living room, testified Djenad, who felt as if he'd found an older brother. He assured me that it would be an easy hit, without violence, that your jewelry would be reimbursed by their insurance company, Djenad recalled. After a few glasses, I let my guard down completely. The 222nd call we got was convincing enough to be the second one we took seriously, said Shaw, explaining how the reward dangled after the December robbery soon yielded another lead. The caller claimed to know the criminals and where they were, and they were from the neighborhoods, from Le Parisien's readership circle. The informant provided the names Farid Alou and Dudu Yahyaoui. Their phones were immediately wiretapped, with microphones covertly placed inside Dudu's Jaguar. Knowing their calls could be traced, the two men were careful not to contact each other, but they had no idea how closely they were being watched or that their pay phone usage was also being monitored. Police recorded Dudu talking percentages and carats and discussing the Rappaport diamond price list, also known as the RAP list. There were also references to La Grosse Pierre, the 31-carat diamond ring stolen in the second robbery. Other members of their crew were busy booking 16,000 euro vacations and renting Lamborghini Spiders with cash deposits. Their code to announce payouts over the phone was a couplet from the French national anthem, La Marseillaise. The day of glory has arrived. On the evening of June 21st, 2009, Alou drove to Dudu's home alongside two young women in his Renault. Parking next to the curb, he got out of the car alone and crossed the street, looking around cagily in all directions. Sensing that something was not right, he turned back. After driving around the neighborhood for a while, he returned. This time, Dudu came out of his home to greet him with a bag containing 49,750 euros. The two men embraced. As the money passed into Alou's hands, officers in ski masks swarmed them. In February 2015, Dudu, Alou, Djenad, and five accomplices were tried on a litany of charges, including armed robbery involving an organized criminal group. Because prosecutors believed he was the leader of the group and considered him a security threat, Dudu watched the trial unfold from the confines of a securitized glass compartment. French court room reporters described his presence as quasi-demonic. Prosecutors detailed how they found a number of the stolen jewels from the second heist, as well as 800,000 euros inside a plaster wall in his compound. A subsequent raid on his home uncovered La Grosse in a plastic jar of face cream, that signature Pink Panther move, buried deep within a concrete drain pipe out back. Adding to the intrigue, Dudu was also in possession of a fully operational RBM-80 rocket launcher of Yugoslavian provenance. Dudu's lawyers insisted that he'd only been a middleman. He argued that the court was trying to make him wear a hat that's too big for my head. While he admitted that the plan had been hatched with Djenad at La Divette, and that he was complicit in storing the take, he swore that he'd brought the plan to others who'd orchestrated it all. The court did not buy Dudu's version. He was the brains of the team, argued Sylvie Kachiner for the prosecution. He is the one who organized everything, recruited the robbers, gave instructions, and was in charge of selling the jewelry. To this day, Dudu claims that the real ringleader, whom he won't snitch on, is still free, and conceivably a Pink Panther. At the trial, video footage of the second robbery was played to the courtroom, showing the men in their makeup and silk babushka kerchiefs. Alou acknowledged being the one dressed like Bernadette Chirac, with a dainty little purse on a shoulder strap. Magistrates pressed him to confess that he'd been a leader of the group. "What does it mean to be a boss?" he replied. "If I'm the boss, me, I send little people in to do the actual work." "Did another boss give you the information?" "I won't name names. No hints," Alou replied. "I was invited and I followed, and that's it." Doreen Carvajal covered the case for the New York Times Paris Bureau. What struck her about Alou was his flagrant attitude, his hauteur. "He was almost blaming it on Harry Winston," she says. "He said he'd been invited, like it was an art opening." Despite his grittiness, Alou created an oddly literary impression in the courtroom. "He was like someone out of an old gangster movie in the way he talked," Carvajal says. "He took responsibility for his part, but he would not rat on the brains." On the stand, Alou spoke of how he'd changed since the heist, and not for the better. "Harry Winston had been at a different time for him," he said. "It was an era when I believed in friendship more than anything else. Now I don't have a friend anymore. I am alone." "Why do you say that?" asked the prosecution. "I used to have one friend," he clarified, "but it was unrequited. He mocked me to my face." Alou and Dudu had nearly come to blows after Alou was caught speeding with the 40,000 euros. Dudu could not believe how careless he'd been and was merciless in his contempt. Still, he helped find someone who vouched for the cash, providing custom letters outlining the provenance of the funds from abroad. Prosecutors encouraged Alou to condemn his former best friend, but he refused, speaking only of their relationship as terminated. Of his many ailments, he seemed more broken-hearted than anything else. The inside man, Mahlud Dejenad, cracked completely. In the lead-up to the trial, he revealed to investigators that he deactivated the alarm sensors in the stairwell the night before the first robbery, allowing the robbers to spend the night inside undetected. "If I hadn't been fired," he added, "I think there could have been 3 or 4 more robberies." Unlike Alou or Dudu, he expressed sincere regret for his actions, telling the court that he was ashamed every day, but I cannot undo what I've done. He'd been cornered, he said, unable to say no. Genuinely remorseful, he started crying on the stand, head in hands, after an ex-colleague came to testify about the trauma of what happened. She would not even look at him. She just walked right by him, Carvajal says. He'd ruined his life for 50,000 euros. Dejenad's 5-year sentence, 3 of them suspended, ended up being lighter than the 15 years given to Dudu, who'd been eligible for a life sentence. Alou, who received 10 years, did not seem too fazed. He testified that he had by then stopped thinking, that he no longer thinks at all. The prosecutor, Kachner, attempted one final time to get Alou to elaborate on his dynamic with Dudu. It's a total divorce, he replied. "A divorce, as you are well placed to know, is the law. It's each person for themselves." "No," replied Kachner, "because one might think..." "Don't think, madam," he retorted. And that was that. Alou had arrived at the end of thought. Friendless, spurned, gravely ill, incarcerated again, this time awaiting only death. Alou felt condemned to his circumstances by a pitiless world. Pascal Fauré does not buy the argument that society is to blame. On the mantle of his office fireplace is a quote by a World War II French resistance fighter. It's so easy to accuse institutions. We don't ask ourselves if the disaster was not caused by the moral or general character defect, rather than the regime. In June, Fauré and his team were still hearing appeals from the fences involved in the second robbery. "People wonder why it takes so long," said Fauré, his heavy-lidded eye now recalling Peter Falk in Colombo. "But instances of organized criminality such as this, in the milieu of bull sharks, requires proper procedural preparation." Asked why so many jewelry robberies happen in France, he pointed to studies showing that the rate of armed robberies are declining there, despite the ongoing preponderance of jewel-related episodes, such as the Kim Kardashian case, or the practically annual raids in Cannes, or the two hits at the Hotel Ritz Paris last year. John Shaw, the insurance loss adjuster, attributes the phenomenon to the fact that there are traditionally more jewelers per head in France than elsewhere. The French have their own jewelers just like they have their own bakers. As to Dudu's argument that he was not the ringleader, Fauré defers to the court's decision. He does grant, however, that there are sensitivities to this particular case. It connects to other ongoing investigations that he is not at liberty to discuss, he adds, his right eye winking itself shut. The French National Police declined to provide any further comment, noting only that the case may not be definitively closed. "The truth is," says Punch Stanimirovic, "some Pink Panther members don't even know that they are in the Pink Panthers." Elaborating, he refers to the possible behind-the-scenes involvement in the Harry Winston case as a group member called the Engineer, who, he says, has one lung and could have either organized it or he did it. He planned it. He executed it. He was part of it. If so, he says, the Engineer may still be in possession of unrecovered jewels. Of the 881 Harry Winston pieces that were stolen, several hundred were seized at Dudu's property, but 493 items are still unaccounted for. Where they went remains a mystery. Their gang likely smuggled some of them out of France on flights they made before being caught. At least one gemstone shattered when they tried to extract it from its clamps, and another reportedly landed in a most intriguing place. According to a report published in Le Parisien, one of the finest diamonds taken from Harry's has been spotted by sources in Russia on the finger of Lyudmila Putin, who is said to have received it as a gift from her former husband of 30 years, Vladimir Putin. That concludes our story for this evening, Diamonds in the Rough. Just my thought on this is that we've read a lot of these type of stories over the years from Vanity Fair about people who commit crimes, sometimes spectacular crimes like this, where they stole over $100 million in diamonds. And yet they always, well, they don't always get caught. The ones we read about are the ones that get caught. There may be a lot of people out there who are doing the same kind of thing and not getting caught. And of course, they're not writing up too many long stories about the ones that got away. We always read about the ones that get caught. The ones that get caught, they always do themselves in. And there's a couple of examples of it here in this story. Once they got the money, how flagrantly they were and throwing it around and acting like they came into all this big money all of a sudden and talking about it with other people and just acting in a different fashion than they had before. You know, one day they're just working class people, and the next day they're, you know, buying Lamborghinis and taking long vacations and et cetera, et cetera. And they just kind of, and they talk about it, and they always get caught. I've said it before and I'll say it again. They did this twice. $100 million if they had just, and they got away with the first one, and they really had no clue until the second robbery occurred. They had $37 million worth of diamonds and jewelry. If they had even, and of course they're not going to get that kind of money selling it on the black market, but even if they got 10%, it would be almost $4 million. And these guys, even though there was a four or five people involved, if they split that up amongst themselves, they'd have more money than they could make in a lifetime just on that split. But nope, get greedy, talk it up, spend that money, do it again second time, and now they're all in jail, in prison. And actually, I was kind of surprised, for stealing $100 million worth of jewelry, they only got, I think the ringleader, Dudu, got 15 years. Not bad. I mean, he's not going to get any of the money back, although he may, because they're still missing about half the loot. But still, 15 years, and the others got a whole lot less than that. I guess it's worth the risk. But I wouldn't advise it. Let's wrap up the evening with a short article called Out of the Office, spotlight being on Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is nestled into a corner booth at the San Ysidro Ranch on a gloomy late spring day, a few weeks after Veep's seven-season flambeing of U.S. politics has come to its ash-black finale. AirPods in and curly brown hair pinned to the nape of her neck, she's 3,000 physical and psychological miles away from Selina Meyer, the soulless D.C. swamp creature she played on the HBO series. You might even mistake her as one of the rarefied women who can while away a Monday afternoon lunching at one of the finest establishments in all of California. I said to my husband, I'm taking July and August off. And he kind of laughed, she says. I'm going to try to stick to it, she continues, then pauses. I'm looking for a new psychiatrist as we speak. Louis-Dreyfus has won the Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actress in a comedy series for each of the show's previous six seasons, combined with another in the category for her work on The New Adventures of Old Christine in 2006, and won a decade earlier for Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Comedy for Seinfeld. Louis-Dreyfus is currently tied with Cloris Leachman for the most acting Emmys in history. It seems all but certain she will have the honor to herself as of awards night this year. She has had, in other words, one of American comedy's most fruitful runs, and a little break might seem to be in order. Yet, when we met, there was still much to do. One last Veep Emmy campaign, post-production on her upcoming film, her youngest son's college graduation. Work, it turns out, and really only good work at that, is where Louis-Dreyfus seems to feel most complete. She loves grinding through a scene until the rhythm rings just right, when the jokes fly high and the insults land with finely calibrated precision. She seems to take breaks only when they are thrust upon her. So there's Louis-Dreyfus' undeniable work ethic to contend with, but there's also the fact that with rest comes thought, and the unenviable task of unpacking all that's happened to her in the last 3 years. Her beloved father died in September of 2016. The following year, doctors diagnosed her with stage 2 breast cancer. She underwent 6 rounds of chemotherapy and a double mastectomy. Then, just as Veep was set to start filming, her 44-year-old half-sister died of an accidental drug overdose. I hate to have to think about it, she says, but I'm very happy to be alive. Lately, she's been trying mindfulness. I realize I did not meditate this morning, like an asshole, but I should have because it's useful. But stillness is just not her strong suit. And Hollywood does seem to be opening up to her in ways that are likely to accommodate her blooming ambitions, primarily delving into things that are not necessarily comedic. I want to expand my creative universe here. I want to do stuff that maybe people would not think I would do, she says. her turn opposite James Gandolfini in Nicole Hoff Center's 2013 drama-infected romantic comedy, Enough Said, demonstrated that desire. Her dramatic vocabulary was also there at times in Veep, if you were paying attention, especially the moments when life was not going the way Meyer planned. That range will be front and center in Downhill, based on the 2014 Swedish film Force Majeure, a 5 years in the making passion project she produced and stars in opposite Will Ferrell. Louis Dreyfus plays a woman in crisis, not the kind of manufactured ordeal Meyer trafficked in, but an actual human calamity wherein the life she thought she had turns out to be a total sham. I just need time to think, she says, on what will come after that. So I'm thinking, formulating my next move, and shit like that. Which is fun, but it also requires thought. And sometimes maybe no thought. Maybe I need time to just look at those flowers and think, wow, that's amazing. What a gorgeous arrangement. But soon she is racing out of the restaurant as Veep showrunner David Mandel's number is ringing on her phone. We've got to go write something, she says as she heads out the door. And with that, we conclude this edition of Vanity Fair Magazine. Thank you so much for joining us this evening. I'm Paul Droba, and on behalf of myself and everyone here at Radio Reading Services in Cincinnati, thanks for joining us, and until next week, good night.